This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, good afternoon. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Tina Camellia. On June 9th, Dr. Abhimanyu Virakramasivam sailed past more than 2,000 scientists from 27 countries to clinch the FameLab International 2016 Best Science Communicator Award. Dr. Abhi presented a talk on cancer genetics at the EDF Arena at the Times Cheltenham Science Festival. He joins me today to share the meaning behind his achievement and why science communication by scientists is essential. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Abhi. Thank you for dropping by.
Thank you.
Congratulations on your win. What made you sign up for this competition?
Yeah, it's you know, first of all, I like to challenge myself. And I feel like, you know, when you are, you know, too long in your zone of comfort, sometimes you become really complacent. And it's also a realization that, you know, as a scientist, you know, communication is an important part of it. And really, ever since I went to uni, you know, the communication part of it hasn't really been my area of focus, rather, you know, much more in science. And, you know, the greater disenchantment, you know, in STEM amongst, you know, our young generation, we hear biggest concerns that, you know, very few students are enrolling in schools in science, has made many scientists, at least in Malaysia, realize the need to communicate the wonders of science, as well as the, you know, with the recent increase in anti-vaccination, is another example of how, you know, science don't really speak for itself, but we need to make a difference. And so I felt like this competition provided me the avenue to sort of test my ability as well as, you know, learn techniques of communication.
Did you have a background in science communication before joining this competition? Were you doing something privately?
No. So I've had a couple of, you know, opportunities, but essentially most of the science communication I've been involved is in science outreach work, and sort of communicating, you know, science to kids and whatever. And that's when I realized that there were gaps in my ability, you know, to communicate science. And so that's when,
yeah. So how was the whole competition process like? I'm sure there's a local level competition first before you ended up in the final leg. So how did the whole process, I mean, how long was that and what did you have to go through?
So I think the whole process, I mean, it was about, say, 4 months or so. The first thing is that at a local level, where the local competition was organized by MITE and British Council Malaysia. And what they did was they opened for applications where applicants would submit a video of what they want to talk about. And the shortlisted applicants were then you know, asked to attend a heats round where we presented our 3 minutes and were judged. And from there, 10 individuals were identified as the finalists for the Malaysian FameLab. And British Council and MITE then organized what was called a Researcher Connect training and a masterclass training where they brought in a science communication expert from the UK who ran 2 days of science communication training. And then there was the finals a couple of weeks later. And I was lucky to win that finals, and that meant that I would represent Malaysia at the FameLab International Competition, which is essentially the World Championship for Science Communication. There were 27 participants, and we were divided into 3 semifinals, which they call as tremifinals. And in each semifinals, 3 individuals were in a sort of selected by the judges, and another 3 by audience vote. I was lucky to be selected as one of the finalists by the judges. And at the finals on the 9th, the 12 of us then, you know, competed at the finals. And I guess the rest is history.
Yeah. So how is it like to be among other science communicators, people who share your enthusiasm for science communication from around the world? What was that experience like?
Yeah, I mean, you know, to be honest, again, huge. I mean, I never really expected to see, you know, such great diversity, but together everyone, you know, sharing the same goal. So although it was a competition and everyone will say, oh no, we don't really want to win, it's not about winning, you know, but, you know, you could see the intensity of the competition in the background of so much of camaraderie and sharing of different avenues, because different people had different backgrounds. They were also at different stages of their scientific careers or education, as well as their expertise. So what is exciting was the Cheltenham Science Festival. Also it's in a really small town, but it attracts these thousands of people people and various different organizations and universities across the country to come and set up booths. So they even had a live interview with Tim Peake, the British astronaut, you know, and then there were just multiple tents, you know, from, you know, basic biology, right, to chemistry, to physics, to astrophysics, and yeah, it was just a whole celebration of science.
Right. The competition format allowed the judges to, if I understand correctly, it allowed the judges to give feedback immediately and ask follow-up questions while you're on stage right after your presentation. And I think receiving constructive criticism, especially in front of a large crowd, that can be quite intimidating. And it might even be, I would say, a deterrent for a lot of people, let alone scientists, to speak in public. How did you feel about that element in the competition?
So, I mean, I think that was one of the reasons I actually wanted to go out there. I think too many scientists, I mean, especially Malaysian scientists, including a lot of my postgraduate students, they are just so scared to say, I don't know, or to say, okay, there are room for improvement and I'll try and improve myself. So one of the reasons why I actually attended initially was to challenge some of my students, you know, to say that, say, even if I can go out there, and the judges are going to ask me any questions, and then some of them are not going to like the way I present things, and I'm going to learn from the criticism to actually build on that. So with regards to this, a lot of scientists, they are so scared, you know, they have something called an imposter syndrome, and this is actually a known syndrome, and I think it really afflicts a lot of our Malaysian scientists, because there's an inability to internalize that we are actually quite good. So they are so scared to go out there because they're going to be caught out, you know, that, oh, they're not good enough, or people are not going to think that they're good enough. And so that's that fear. So, you know, in my case, I felt that I had a message to actually share. And if I did not know the question, I was prepared to say, I don't know. But I was just very lucky that all the questions that they actually asked me, I was able to answer them.
All right. What do you think, just now you mentioned briefly about the Malaysian scientists. What do you think, or how do you think Malaysians fare in terms of science literacy?
Yeah, so I think if you're talking about just Malaysians, in general, there is actually a desire. I mean, for example, I have actually been involved with PetroScience, and I've been amazed that, you know, the PetroScience Centre in KLCC and the various different satellite centres actually have 1 million visitors each year. The science outreach activities that we've actually done from Johor to Terengganu to Sabah and Sarawak, you know, also show us that kids and parents alike are very interested in science. And we continuously obviously have to like apologize that we're closing the, you know, it's just an amazing experience. But then, you know, I know that universities are struggling to attract science students. So there's obviously, you know, something that's happening, you know, at the grassroots level right up to at university. There's mm-hmm. that gap there. And I think part of it's because a combination of the scientists as well as the media, the way we sort of portray science, the way we portray scientists' careers, that's another problem. I think especially in Asian communities where it's always about how much money you're going to make after you graduate, the failure to actually see that, you know, science and careers in science is not confined in the laboratories, and there can be, you know, so many more opportunities out there, perhaps, you know, creates that big divide. Amongst, you know, but at the university level, and I've been very lucky, for example, I chair the Young Scientist Network of the Academy of Sciences Malaysia, and this is really the organization that represents the top young scientists in the country. You know, I'm surrounded by young scientists who are way more talented than I am, and I'm always very humbled, you know, by the opportunities that I've had, as well as to be amongst, you know, really amazing scientists. And so I think, for example, thank you, you know, for inviting me today. But I think this is where I think the scientists need to put themselves out there a little bit, so that the science doesn't just speak for itself, but the scientists, you know, sort of present that, you know, to the public.
Mm-hmm. How has the internet or social media made science more accessible to the masses? Or is it making information more confusing?
So I think there's a double-edged sword there. The internet and the social media and, you know, platforms such as YouTube have provided a lot of avenues for experts to distill, you know, scientific information as well as share the latest advancements. I, for one, use YouTube, you know, as a source of inspiration and tools, even when I'm actually teaching students. But the flip side of it is because these forms of communication patient do not actually have a filtering or a review or a peer review system. And so, usually it's style versus, you know, substance over substance. And so what happens is when we oversimplify science or we misrepresent science, I mean, by non-experts and presented it as an expert point of view, this, you know, might result in misinformation. And unfortunately, we live in a period where conspiracy theory and myths, you know, trump facts. And so... this is where, again, it is so important for media and the scientists to actually work together so that we identify true experts to really address these issues. Mm-hmm. I think it's really, you know, very, very scary that the, you know, the candidate British Prime Minister, you know, who might replace David Cameron, Michael Gove, you know, before the Brexit elections did say that, you know, when the experts were all, you know, really concerned, you know, Britain was going to vote for Leave, you know, his statement that we are sick of listening to experts. It's about time we listen to the people. And I think this is a huge problem when emotions and natural sentiments trumped, you know, facts. So I think Malaysia, not so bad. I think, you know, they still regard experts and there's an element of, you know, understanding. But again, I think for me, this current anti-vaccination issue that's really hot here, I think really emphasizes the need for science communication and scientists to make their voices heard.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking to Dr. Abhimanyu Virkramasivam, the newly minted FameLab International Best Science Communicator. Next, I'm going to put him on the spot and have him reprise his performance on stage. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
In the last 5 seconds, two people have just found out that they have cancer, and one life has been lost through cancer. This is our battle against cancer. Cancer cells are normal cells that have acquired specific DNA damage, or what we call as mutations, that give cancer cells superpowers. But what are these superpowers? One, they grow faster than normal cells. Two, they develop resistance to therapy. And three, they can spread to other parts of the body. One of the new and exciting ways my colleagues and I are working on is to harness the power of viruses. Yes, the scary viruses. We are now able to design and engineer viruses that are safe and are equipped with superpowers that are able to combat cancers. First, cancer cells grow faster than normal cells, and that is why they form big tumors. But these viruses that are more than 1,000 times smaller divide 100 times faster than cancer cells. Once the virus enters a cancer cell, it hijacks the cancer cell to make more viruses, and before the cancer cell can divide, these baby viruses inside the cell will kill the cell and go on to infect the remaining cancer cells in the body. What is great is that these viruses do not infect normal cells and thus will have limited side effects. Second, cancers have the ability to evolve resistance to therapy. A single tumor in a patient usually consists of multiple clusters of cancer cells that coexist and co-evolve together. So when a patient undergoes surgery, chemotherapy, or radiotherapy, and the tumor appears to be shrinking and disappearing, what usually happens is that although the majority of the cells have been destroyed, there are still some cells that have survived, but are undetectable. And given some time, these resistant cells will form new tumors, resulting in recurrence. What is great is that we can now engineer these viruses to specifically target and kill these cancer cells that are resistant to therapy. And finally, cancer cells are able to spread throughout the body by escaping the natural kryptonite, our immune system. And this spread, which we call metastasis, is what kills most patients. For example, an intestinal cancer that spreads into the liver or into the bone, but these viruses not only directly kills the cancer cells, but they're able to activate the immune cells so that they can track and join in the battle to destroy cancer cells that have spread throughout the body. But despite the advancements in cancer therapy, including what we just heard about harnessing the power of viruses to stop cancer growth, resistance, and spread, prevention is better than cure, and so is early diagnosis. 1/3 of all cancers can be avoided today if we modified our lifestyles and protect our environment to limit DNA damage. And more importantly, celebrate and communicate science and facts so that we not only advance public health, but also affect positive political will.
It's Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Tina Camellia, and you've just heard Dr. Abi with his piece on cancer genetics. Dr. Abi is in the studio with me today to spread the important message of strengthening scientific literacy through science communication. Dr. Abi, how did you become interested in science? Who were your early influences?
So I don't really have a single event that triggered it. I mean, I've been very lucky, you know, to grow up in an environment where my parents, you know, were actively, you know, encouraging to try my best and provided me, you know, encyclopedias and science was always pretty much, you know, in my family, even in my larger family. I think my schools played a huge role. From Sekolah Rendah Kebangsaan Teruntum and Sekolah Menengah Kebangsaan Sultan Abu Bakar in Kuantan. I would like to give a shout out to my teachers as well as my friends who were, you know, amazingly competitive and collaborative and, you know, were able to inspire me, you know, to enjoy science. We had great laboratories and teachers to teach us and practice. But I really think my career in science began to crystallize when I was at uni. First at the Faculty of Medicine and Health Sciences, where I did my undergraduate project with Professor Dr. Xiao Heng Fong. And then later on, when I went to Cambridge to do my PhD, it was definitely, you know, an amazing opportunity to really understand how science can actually be translated immediately to affect, you know, patient outcomes. I've been back for the last 8 years, you know, and so I think, you know, my career and my perception of how I think I can impact science in Malaysia has changed over the years. Working with the Academy of Sciences Malaysia has definitely opened my view on how science can not only be used for a specific scientific question, which I'm answering in the lab, but also to actually improve the ecosystem that we have.
The bulk of your medical research is in cancer genetics. Was it cancer or was it genetics that captured your attention first?
So genetics, I mean, even when I was at school, I mean, I always was amazed by the genes. And, you know, even at that time, there was so little that we knew. And, you know, in 20 years, our view of genetics has changed. Mm-hmm. So I think initially genetics, but the desire to actually answer this emperor of maladies called cancer. I even have a friend, I mean, who just got diagnosed from cancer just two weeks ago. Really close friend, amazing individual and soul. And it's events like this that just reminds me why I want to fight this battle and why it's so important to actually answer this question in the context of Malaysians, because there is a genetic difference in the way individuals respond, and we know our genetics are different. And so there is obviously an Asian component that we need to dissect, but more so making sure that the drugs or the diagnostics that we actually have is cheap enough so that the average Malaysian can actually you know, pay for it and actually benefit from the science and research and development that the public.
Could you describe what a day in the life of Dr. Abi is like as an academic, as a researcher?
Yeah. So my friends who are actually listening to this will probably laugh because this is where I think a career in science is just amazing. And the career that I managed to forge, I think, you know, it's extremely diverse. I would say on an average, you know, a day would involve meeting my students, finding out what they have done in the lab, trying to troubleshoot experiments, checking out my cancer cells, whether, you know, they are fine or not, whether they've been able to be, you know, killed by specific modifications that's been done. Then I'm involved in teaching. I teach both biomedical science undergraduate students as well as medical doctor program. And then I also have classes with my master's and PhD program students. And then many meetings, you know, with regards to how can we get more money for grants to support my next year's, you know, worth of work. And then I'm also involved in multiple projects. I chair the Research Development and Commercialization Working Group for the Science Outlook 2017, which is Malaysia's science report on its state of science and its future outlook. And by chairing the Young Scientist Network, we have multiple projects, outreach programs. We have at least 10 outreach programs. And in August, we'll be concluding the National Science Challenge, where 12,000 16-year-old kids in the country take part. And the three winners will attend the Nobel Prize-winning ceremony in Stockholm. Wow. So, you know, unfortunately, I can't actually tell you what I do in a single day. But that's pretty much, I think, covers, you know, what my week would look like.
Speaking of being an academician, you are training new scientists, researchers. What is your take on the state of the country's research and postgraduate programs?
Yeah, so I think the key difference that many of the research environment that maybe if you were to compare with the top universities in the UK or US is the number of students actually working on and basically so the robustness of the ecosystem. But if you were to objectively look at the Malaysian, you know, postgraduate training and the R&D system, it's actually extremely competitive. The Ministry of Science and especially the Ministry of Higher Education has provided many grants for researchers, especially in research universities, including UPM, to have significant amounts of money to conduct research. And this means that students are able to actually work on high-end experiments. Most students are exposed to the latest technologies, but I think maybe the discourse might be limited because the number of students actually working in a specific area. And this applies even for me. I think that the only difference that I find perhaps lacking in Malaysia is a larger scientific community to sort of even critique your work so that you can actually improve.
There's a stereotype about scientists being, you know, reclusive, they're introverted, socially awkward. Why do you think such stereotypes exist?
Well, we blame the media. No, I think it's part of the efforts to popularize science. You know, we have this idea of a scientist built on the imagery of Einstein and also Frankenstein. You know, so there's this you know, perhaps slightly romantic idea that, you know, scientists are just extremely, you know, introverted and all they want to do is to find things and world domination, you know, what have you. And I think this is where the story is changing. Mm-hmm. We are starting to get new icons of science. I mean, and especially in the UK and the US, I mean, you have many people coming forward and sharing. And, you know, a lot of these amazing scientists that have made amazing discoveries are mothers, you know, your best friends, you know, people who like baking cupcakes, you know, who have a social life. For example, I like dancing salsa. You know, perhaps my wife will complain that I don't do it enough and spend too much time in the lab. But I think, you know, this is it. There's the whole spectrum of individuals. We love to label people, all right? And I think it's because scientists, a lot of times we speak, you know, with the inability to understand that people are not understanding what we are saying, perhaps that gap grows and perhaps certain stereotypes, you know, become more evident. So it's so important, you know, for us to actually make the effort, you know, to communicate science so that people then see us as human beings. And more importantly, what I find most exciting is for people to realize that if Abi can also do it, that means there's so many kids out there who obviously can achieve a lot more.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the best strategy to improve the scientific information from crossing from the academic bubble to the masses?
Yeah, so I think one solution is not going to fit all. I think we have to give credit to, you know, Malaysia. I think Malaysia is extremely heterogeneous. I mean, it's something that I think is extremely worth celebrating. But with that comes the problem that, you know, different people have different perceived realities. And when I speak about heterogeneity, it does not only apply to one that is defined by race or religion, but also from, you know, different geography, you know, socioeconomic status, education, and whatever view. And so the idea here is to actually have different, you know, sort of messages that are tuned, you know, at different levels. So another important thing is that we think that the scientists should be the one responsible, you know, in communicating the science directly to the public. But actually, that might not be the best option, because as much as we try, we might not be as good as you are, you know. So what we need to do is to communicate this to champions. Champions who we build, you know, strong trust and a relationship where we are able to communicate science without oversimplifying. And then, you know, people like yourselves, media personnel, or people on the ground, like the, you know, say, for example, Ketua Kampung or, you know, school teacher in that area that's well respected, can then be the mouthpiece, you know, that shares, you know, these stories of science, the rest of it. So the Academy of Sciences, together with the Ministry of Science, has piloted a program called Duta Science. And so this Duta, or Ambassadors of Science, is not the scientists, but actually identifying people on the ground, the everyday machi and the pachi and the uncle and aunties, you know, who are already engaged, but may not be as informed. And so now the scientist provides that information to them, provides avenues and fairs and festivals for these uncles and aunties to then bring in their people that they actually, you know, care about, as well as some influence on them, so that, you know, they can share the wonders of science.
For young scientists, how and where can they improve their communication skills just to get them off the ground, so to speak?
So I think if you're talking about, you know, people with PhDs or in academia, is that what you're referring to in general? So I think, first of all, they need to just break the inertia and fear. You know, I think this whole idea of suffering from the imposter syndrome, I think they just need to break from that. They need to realize that people are not judging them all the time. I mean, I think the problem is that scientists are such critics. And so, you know, we fear that everybody is also critiquing us, you know, with such high resolution. But the reality is not. I think, you know, we have a responsibility, and therefore, we have to shatter our own inhibitions. So the first thing is to just go out there. You know, say yes to any opportunity to share your views and then fear later. You know, that's my ethos, at least. So that's number one. The second one, I think, you know, being fluent in specific languages are also important. I think while English is extremely integral if you want to be competitive internationally, but also your own languages, you know, Malay and Chinese and Tamil, you know, might be more useful in communicating the essence of science. So I think trying different ways to sort of, you know, speak it. And one of the things about science communication, which I like to share with most scientists, is that, at least in mine and many of my friends who have actually gone into science communication, realize that sometimes we think that we are, you know, benefiting the public by communicating science. But a lot of time, actually, the benefit is bi-directional. I, for one, have learned a lot. For example, even, you know, in my fight against cancer, I've learned a lot about understanding what is it that's important in our community through the communication with society, so that we, especially if you're trained overseas, you know, we continuously try to play catch up with what's happening around the world, but forget what is actually most important, you know, which is answering your own society's needs. And so I think if more scientists can understand that, actually by creating a bidirectional dialogue also helps them improve their science, also helps to distill the ideas of science, that might actually encourage them to actually go out there.
Mm-hmm. So finally, what's your message to listeners who are interested in science?
So first of all, you know, have a very open mind. And I think it is so important that parents, teachers, and everyone, sometimes we are over-dependent on the government. But the reality is that, you know, the individual can actually effect so much change on another individual. And so I implore everybody, you know, involved in the education of a young child to provide, you know, the opportunities that are actually out there for these kids to explore, you don't have to be a scientist to speak science and celebrate science, and you also don't have to be a scientist to contribute to society. But if there are kids and Malaysian kids who have this natural aptitude to excel in science, let's give them the right motivation and right opportunities so that they can then carry on the many different efforts that Malaysia has made to progress its science in the 21st century, and make sure that this progress is not only sustainable, but take it up to another level.
Thank you so much, Dr. Abi, for your time. I hope you continue your effort to improve science literacy in Malaysia and globally. And you're always welcome to come back here and use radio as yet another medium to do so. I've been speaking to Dr. Abhimanyu Veerakumarasivam, the newly crowned FameLab International Best Science Communicator 2016. You're listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.